Hey, it's Elisa Monjadas, Managing Director of Stories Bureau, and this is my co-host, Creative Director of Stories Bureau.
Hey, everyone, I'm Corey Grushka, and this is B2B Creatively, where we want to talk about all things B2B creative, from trends to best practices, campaigns that succeeded.
So that all of us together can learn how to B2B creatively.
If you're a marketer, you'll learn how to be more creative, and if you're a creative, we're going to make you more strategic.
Corey, before I met you, I was like obsessed with people with big visions and always like had a passion for creatives. So when I met you, you were a visionary creative, the two. And it was like, my favorite person. So do you think that all visionaries like have to be creative? Like, do they have to go together?
I think it has to go together. A visionary, I think by definition, is someone that sees a path that's not really there, right? And so I think by definition, that's creative. I think the interesting part about true visionaries is that the idea of like, can you inspire people around a vision? It's like about the risk, and can you inspire people around taking the risk and acting on it, right?
So like without sharing it with someone, you know, and like, and showing them what it could look like.
Right. And inspiring them to actually act on the vision. You know what I mean? That's the point of difference here, I think. And there's a lot of people that have vision in their living room or whatnot, you know, have ideas, have big ideas.
Anyone who like yells at the television, like it could be like
super visionaries, those people. Yeah. But the key to the whole thing is like actually actioning it. And how do you do that? It's like getting people to take risks, selling your vision, I think is the secret sauce there.
Corey, you're going to love the conversation I had with my former CMO, because she had the arduous task of having a vision and then having to sell it. And it's all about creating something that didn't exist before, which that's the creative part, right?
Like 100%.
The vision does not exist, but the creating the vision is like, you have to create what wasn't there before. So now that I'm talking to you, I'm like, one can't go without the other.
The creative is seeing it, but then the value is actioning it, I think, you know, is inspiring people around it. But no, you can't have a visionary that's not creative, I don't think.
Okay, well, let's see what Don has to say.
Hi, I'm Don Colossi, the Chief Marketing Officer at Software AG. We are a German-based software company that sells solutions for digital transformation.
Don, Corey and I have been talking a lot about what it means to be a visionary and what it means to be a creative, because I think that they go hand in hand in some areas, especially when it comes to leadership. And I know you talk a lot about leadership and your content that you create. So for you, what does it mean to be a visionary creative?
So that's an interesting question. I think a visionary has to see into the future, right? And I always think for a leader, it's really important to be able to communicate that and the possibility to your team. And it's not at all suggesting that leaders have a crystal ball and they know what's going to happen, right? But it's pointing to the things that are happening around you that are going to spark change and what that could end up looking like. And it does lend itself to creativity, right? Because it's not a known. If it was a known, then creativity doesn't come into it, right? And I think creativity is really the most emotional communicator that you can have, right? We've all seen really bad content or really bad, you know, produced stock photos or all of that. And it's bad because it's flat. It lacks soul. It lacks emotion, right? So when you're talking about what's going to change and what's going to happen in the future, that evokes all kinds of human emotions. How is that going to affect me? Am I afraid of the change? Am I excited about the change? Like, there's all kinds of human emotions there. If you can use your creative to tap into those emotions, now you've connected with your audience, because they also are having those feelings, right? Mm-hmm. So your creative has to communicate that or feel that, not corporate stock photo that's completely flat and soulless, because at the end of the day, change is probably one of the hardest human things we go through. And so that emotional connection through creativity is essential in order to be able to be a visionary, and to be able to connect with you know, the people around you, not only people who work with you, but the people who you are marketing to, and create that emotional connection.
I love the connection between not just you, but your customer, because one of my favorite leadership mantras is inspire a shared vision. And I haven't really thought about inspiring a shared vision, not just with you and your company, but with the people that you're marketing to. Yeah. I mean, it makes so much sense now that you say it out loud. I'm like, why have I never thought of this before? But it's really cool how you connected the two.
Thank you. It was definitely an unexpected question. So it was on the spot.
Yes. Thank you for indulging me. Okay. You used to be my boss.
I know.
It's been about 5 years, 6 years, something like that, I think. And something that you impacted or like pressed upon me as my former leader was this book that you had our team read. It's called Play Bigger, How Pirates, Dreamers, and Innovators Create and Dominate Markets. And I love that book. It really like spoke to the rule breaker in me and my entrepreneurial spirit. Like, if it doesn't exist, just create it.
Right.
And like, you, when you're an innovator or a visionary creative, like you can actually dominate a market by creating your own category. And now here we are, fast forward, you actually did it. You like launch your own, like what? How did that even happen?
It is kind of amazing. So I love that book too. And I've read it a number of times with a number of different teams. And, you know, the first time I read it was not when we were working together. It was before that at a previous company. And it made a whole lot of sense. And again, there it is, right? Trying to see what we know what today is. What does the future look like? And can I invent for the future? And can I be creative around that, right? And then we read it and we didn't quite execute on that, right? But it was an inspiring conversation. And then here I am. And I was presented last year from the product team on they wanted to do a product launch. And I went, ugh. How 1995? Sure, let's tell everybody the new features in our product, right? And I don't like doing things because people asked me to do them. Mm-hmm. I want to do the right thing to help the company grow. So obviously I didn't say no, because then I wouldn't have a job if I'm difficult to work with. And so right. I listened and I kept going to meetings. And when I heard about what they were planning for our product, and just to explain, so the product that we're talking about is a 25-year-old product from a 54-year-old software company, and a product we acquired from a startup that hasn't quite hit its momentum yet, right? But it was bringing data and application integration together. And so when I started listening, I just started asking questions like, is anyone else doing this? Is this how people are buying? When you're in a meeting with our customers, are they asking these questions? And the more I pressed, the more I got to a, wow, this actually isn't a product launch. This is a different category. It was not met with open arms by any stretch of the imagination.
Okay, hold on. I need to stop you here, because you had this product that maybe in some people's eyes could be seen as like antiquated.
Yes.
We've been there for so long. There's so much legacy attached to it. And now you're coming in and saying, well, actually, this is something brand new. Is that what I mean?
And here's the most ironic part, Elisa. I spent most of the beginning of the year fighting that team because they wanted to do a very big splash about around the 25th anniversary of the product. And I was like, oh, no. I said,
I love that you hate boring, by the way.
I fought it and fought it. I was like, you do not put out that your software is 25 years old. That is not a positive. Gosh. Oh, yeah. No, but we're solid and dependable. I'm like, you're old, right? Like it was started before the iPhone. Like, you don't want to do that. Now, of course, there's been innovation and everything, but why would you put a number to that? You know, yes. I mean, I was like, you're just hurting yourself. There's just a negative connotation there. So yeah, it was groundbreaking for me to go, no. If you're bringing these two products together and you're able to solve an enterprise level product that right now is being solved by what Gartner was calling a Franken market, right? Like you had to piece together all of the pieces to get your plumbing to work basically, because it's middleware. Mm. But we were going to supply this vision of a holistic world where you had oversight over your entire enterprise while also allowing agility and innovation from your individual teams, which is what they want, right? That was different. That was groundbreaking. So the products kept on doing what they were doing. And yes, we were adding, you know, AI features like everybody else's and all of those things. But at the end of the day, it was really, could you consolidate on this overall platform, again, which is a bad word, right? overall platform to get to the place where, you know, it's solving a lot of the pain that you're feeling as an enterprise. So that's why I saw it as something completely different than a product launch. To go back to, it was not greeted with open arms. I found myself in a lot of contentious conversations. The CEO told me to cut the bullshit. The CPO told me everybody thought I was making excuses. And
excuses for what?
For not having a real product launch.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my goodness. I feel like anyone who's been in like software or technology product launches, like they feel this pain, especially marketers, because there's always tension.
Yeah, there is. And when someone says we want a product launch, there's a blueprint in their mind, right? Yep. I know what a product launch looks like. And I kept going, it's bigger than that. We can make this so much bigger than that. And so you knowing me, I never back down to a good fight, right? Yeah. And I was like, okay, fight on. I really had to do a lot of internal marketing on what the difference was between a product launch and a category launch. You know, and I pulled
You're like, here's copies of the book.
Well, nobody was going to read because they don't even read email. So let alone read a book. Right. So it really was, you know, door to door salesmanship of going to different teams, going to different, you know, executive meetings, going, you know, armed with this deck that explained the difference between a product and a category. And I used some very, you know, known examples, Uber being one of them. Right. It's still somebody you're paying for a ride. Mm-hmm. But it's a ride share. It's no longer a taxi service. And it can change the entire industry, right? You know, the smartphone is probably one of the best examples, right? It was still a mobile phone. We had mobile phones before 2007. And Apple certainly could have decided to call it anything else but a phone because it was so much more than a phone. But they kept the familiarity of the phone because everybody was already carrying one. They didn't have to convince them to carry a phone because everybody was already carrying one. But it was smart.
I'm kind of embarrassed that you had to go through this.
Over and over and over again. And I found that when other folks, you know, sort of tried to take the baton and do it, I still ended up having to come behind that and do the sale. And eventually we got the company behind it. And I basically, you know, said to the CEO, I just feel like you got to trust me on this. And if I fail, you fire me.
Okay. Was this before or after you were named one of the top 100 global B2B CMOs?
Completely before.
Okay.
But I'd also been here, you know, already for 2 years and I'd already turned around our demand gen engine. You know, we started making our numbers, although of course, when you make your numbers, marketing has nothing to do with it. But when you don't make your numbers, it's all marketing's fault. But I said to him, show me a failure of why you wouldn't trust me. And he's like, okay, let's do it. And we did it. It was the first time in the entire history of this company where the entire company got behind a launch. And it really was heavy duty internal marketing, right? I did a weekly update to the entire company, whether that was a video or an email. I created a cross-functional team, which had never happened before. And of course, you know, the first couple of meetings, it was like, who is this marketing lady who thinks she's going to tell us what to do? And when they realized I was just there to ask questions and create connections, everybody put their defense down and really worked really hard as a team. It was just so gratifying to see it. It was all about just getting to know what the purpose was. It wasn't a personal win. It wasn't a personal gain, which I think for some reason, everyone thinks marketing's in it for a personal gain. We don't make any more money for a personal gain.
That's literally not my job.
Right. I don't understand it, right? But my job is audience-based marketing, right? So I'm like, okay, this is my audience, and I have to convince them because I need the company behind me. So it was one of the huge highlights of my career because it had a really great outcome, but it really was what brought the company together.
Yeah, but, because the outcome, I also know the outcome.
Yeah. So let me just explain the launch a little bit. So we decided that we were going to center the launch around an already existing big event that was happening. And this actually is in the book. I got this exactly from the book, right? They call it a lightning strike. And we all rallied around a week in October when Gartner was having their Gartner Symposium in Orlando because it's the biggest gathering of CIOs. So rather than trying to drive people to our own event and so on and so forth, we decided, okay, we're going to use this as our platform for launching. And at the same time, we had stuff going on all over the world. And so it was an amazing, amazing week. The teams across the entire company, everyone, you know, from our professional services to our sales teams, to our marketing teams, to our internal teams to support, you know, all of the systems and the works and everything that had to happen, everyone pulled together and it was an amazing launch. And then we got a call really fast, or the CEO got a call really fast that someone wanted to buy the category that we created.
And what was the category called?
So the category was called Super IPaaS. And that's important because IPaaS already existed, which is integration platform as a service. And it already exists, right, today. And I'm not the person who came up with that, right? It was like the code name. And I was like, okay, let's keep the code name. And I was like, are you crazy? That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. At first, I hated it too. I'm like, oh, what are we in kindergarten? It's a super IPaaS. You know, like I was making fun of it also. And then as I got further and further into it, it was just rolling off of people's tongues. You know what I mean? And we were briefing analysts and they were started saying it back to us. And I'm like, wait a minute, this could be so simple, stupid that we should not change it.
Yeah, it's interesting that you have like super IPaaS with the P and the P, because I've heard that when you have different words, like when you're thinking about naming a company or a product, if you have an X or a P or a CK, like in certain words, so like super IPaaS with the two Ps, it like sticks in the brain more. I don't know if you've like,
no, I didn't even think about that. No, but when I thought about, that's where I sort of used the smartphone again, right? Because I was like, they could have come up with, you know, a much more technical, you know, jargony, whatever name.
Right.
But the fact that it was a phone, which everybody knows, and it's smart, like, you don't forget that. You know what I mean? Yeah. So super IPaaS, it kind of sticks, right?
Yeah.
And it was, I mean, I that was another conversation. And especially with the sales leaders, like, you really expect me to go into a meeting and say the word super IPaaS? I'm like, I do.
Thank you.
And they're like, that's the most ridiculous thing I ever heard. I'm like, I understand, but it's so simple, it sticks. So anyway, we got a call saying, okay, we want to buy it. And we were acquired by a private equity. And of course, we all know that in the private equity world, a successful exit is what is success. That is the ending, is a successful exit. Yeah, so we announced in December that Super IPaaS was selling to IBM for 2.13 billion euros.
Oh my goodness. Clap, 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 insert applause. That's incredible,
so,
Dawn.
Our, you know, that's shareholder value, right? And that's what the goal is, the business goal. My and there is, of course, there are people affected at the company, you know? So while success can't be denied, obviously in these situations, there's people whose jobs will change or not exist anymore or anything. But
yeah, anytime there's that restructuring.
Anytime, but that's what happens in the private equity world. You know, and that's the way business works. I work for a German software company, so culturally that's not quite understood. I think Americans understand that a whole lot more because we've been raised that way, basically, even myself, who've been working a long time. So that's been the hard part, but the business success is undeniable and completely gratifying.
That's amazing. What an incredible story. You know, like we talked about being a visionary and a leader, and I think that something that people forget all the time is feeling like a broken record. Because it's like, as soon as you feel like a broken record, people are just starting to kind of grasp it.
Yeah.
I'm curious for you, what kept you going in that?
I just felt with every fiber of my being, it was the right thing. I just did. As marketers, we're extremely data-driven these days. Mm-hmm. You know, and I do make a lot of my decisions based on what the data is telling me, because usually that's what the customer's telling me, right? That data is telling me what the customer's thinking. But in this case, it was mostly gut. And, you know, I just felt so sure that it was the right thing. I couldn't back down and live with myself. And it's always been my mantra that I have no problem being fired for doing what I thought was right, but I have a big problem being fired for doing what other people told me to do.
For the marketers who are in this world, they understand all the things that come with a new category, new brand. What were some of the tactics that you had? Was it like, did you have to do a new logo? Did you make a landing page? What was your process?
Well, first was the creative. And that was a sort of a tough place because I'm not a creative, but I wanted the creative.
Well, you are creative. We just finished talking about it.
I'm not a graphic designer. I'm not a graphic designer, right? And but I knew what I wanted the creative to communicate. And I really wanted the creative to communicate the chaos that I knew our audience was feeling in their environment. So I needed it to be chaotic. And that's a really hard thing for a graphic designer when you say, I want your design to be chaotic, right? and because they hear messy.
Yeah.
Right? I work with a terrific creative director and the creative team. And an overall really nice guy. So he put up with me every time I was sort of pushing. You know, he would come up with a concept. I'm like, Luke's not messy enough. And he's like, ugh. And I'm like, I need it to feel like, you know, like when you're in your head and all of these things are going on and you have sensory overload. I want it to feel like sensory overload.
Why sensory overload for the solution?
Well, that was the thing, right? Because he's like, but we're trying to add a solution for this. I'm like, yes, the payoff's going to be the digital part of that, right? The digital is going to be calm. It's going to be the contradictory to this is the problem. So I needed the problem to be communicated in a graphic way, but the solution to be presented in a calm way. So all of our digital was very calm, right? It was a lot of white space. It wasn't a lot of words. It was very sparse in the words. And so
you balanced out.
So I balanced out this is how I'm feeling, right? Because I wanted people to sort of see our stuff and go, wait, how did they know the inside of my mind? Right?
Yeah.
I want to watch this. Why? How do they know what's going on in my head? And then, oh, there's the payoff. So that was the first thing. It was getting to a, you know, how do you communicate that, as we talked about at the beginning, in a graphical way? And we got to a beautiful, beautiful place. And we actually ended up having some fun with it. And I also had a push on that because, you know, when you work for an international company, and especially one that's not American. Like, I've always worked for international companies, right? But they've always been American companies and the rest of the world. This is a company that's based in Europe. So they don't quite get our American, you know, humor.
Did you say it was based in Germany?
Germany. But I was like, we got to have fun with it because this is a silly name, right? So you got to have some fun with it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when we were designing t-shirts for the event we were going to be in, or, you know, taglines for what we were going to do, I'm like, why don't we just write, what the heck is a super iPass? Ask me. Right? Yeah. And then I got pushback from Europe going, you can't do that. I was like, all right, just say, what is a super iPass? You know, ask me. And they were like, okay, we can live with that. So you have to make allowances, right? So, but we all walked around Orlando with that and people were stopping us hysterical. They thought that was really funny. And it was on all of our, you know, signatures and banners and everything. So that was the first part, was the creative. The second was, okay, how do we bring all of these tactics together to coordinate? And we ended up doing, you know, a worldwide sort of, you know, launch events, but we brought in our partners, which was a really, really big deal because most of the work that's being done, especially in integration and middleware, is being done through global system integrators, not through the company themselves and not through the vendor. So these are the folks that are actually doing the project. So it was really important to get them involved. So they sponsored that. We, as I said, took over, you know, we did this big launch at the Gartner event. We had our CEO there and talk. We, of course, there was a whole press, you know.
That's like hundreds of thousands of people,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. And we had you know, this whole press tour set up. And then, of course, you know, the digital engine completely changed. We changed our website. We changed all of our nurturing programs. We changed all of our content. We, like, everything changed on that day. Our social presence, you know, exploded. We armed the entire company, you know, with the top 10 things you should do today. You know, so it really was getting everybody involved. There really isn't a marketing tactic that anybody's run that we didn't do as part of this. You know, there were virtual events for our customers, and there was, you know, webinars and hands-on labs and all of the things, you know, to get everyone educated. So it was huge. It was huge.
And it had to be huge.
It had to work. To work. Exactly. It was amazing.
So, okay. Now looking back, it's been a year. What would you recommend to somebody who's like where you were when they were like, this is a new category? Because I personally have seen those opportunities. And as an agency, I can only say so much, yeah, right? I'm a little bit too outside of it. And so it's really up to the product marketers, CMO, those teams to come up with that. But for the people who see that opportunity, what advice would you give them?
You got to have guts, right? Because the easy thing is not to do it. So I don't know that you can talk a CMO who doesn't understand the opportunity into it. Because at the end of the day, that CMO's job is on the line, right? Always. I mean, they don't last very long as it is.
Right.
So, you know, if they're not fully in and they don't understand what it means and what it takes, I don't believe it's something that you can coach somebody through or have the agency bring them through.
It's too hard of a journey.
It's too hard of a journey. So you absolutely need an internal stakeholder. And maybe it doesn't have to be the CMO, right? Like if the CPO sees it or the CEO sees it, you know, maybe you can get around. But there has to be somebody who believes with every fiber of their being internally that it's the right thing to do.
Yeah. And in your case, it was worth it.
It was.
It was worth it for the company. It was worth it.
And it's not for everything, you know? Like I think the dangerous part is, okay, which category are you creating next? It's like, yeah, that's a hard thing to say because I feel like the opportunity has to present itself. You can't really create the opportunity so much. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can. Uber did, obviously, right? I mean, two guys standing in Paris in the rain decided, hey, it would be really cool if we can call a car on our phone and create an Uber. You know what I mean? So yes, you can. But I think it does take a real visionary to do that.
And with a large corporation, you're moving a ship, you know, 1%, 2%
exactly.
at a time. And so for the people who are like, okay, I'm going to take a risk, what would you say when they're having doubts along the way? Like they put a stake in the ground, now they're moving forward, and everyone's like attacking what they have to say.
I think you have two choices. You can say, what could go wrong? Or what happens if it goes right? And you can decide in your own head which side of that fence you're going to sit on. And again, I think it takes a lot of bravery to say, but what if it goes right?
I mean, it takes so much bravery if it goes wrong.
It does. But you know what? That's life. We're not successful at every single thing we do. You know, and you're not going to crush it at every single job. You're just not. Because no human is perfect and no human is the perfect fit for every situation. It doesn't work. It doesn't exist. And I'm always motivated by what can I learn from this? So I thought, okay, the worst that could happen is that this fails miserably and I learn a whole lot for the next time and I lose my job.
Right.
But, you know, I felt confident enough that there's always another job. And I think in almost every single case, there's always another job. I've been working a really long time. There's been a lot of teams that have been downsized and changed and, you know, people left. And I don't know anyone in my history that didn't land perfectly well. I think we have to accept that as humans, that failure is part of being human, and you have to be willing to take that risk. So my question for you, Elisa, you were downsized and I was the person who downsized you.
Yeah.
And here we are talking.
And everything's okay.
Why?
Okay, so I tell this story all the time about when we restructured, and you were the bearer of bad news for me. And I felt like it wasn't you personally, but I felt like a cold thing of water just like fell over my face. It was a terrible feeling.
It is. It's horrible. I've been part of it. It's a horrible feeling.
And I remember you telling me, you're like, I know you don't see it now. And I was like, in the moment, I was like, I hate you, right?
Of course. Yes. Of course.
And you said, I know you don't feel like this right now, but at the time, I was bored. I was really bored at where we were. And I wanted something new. And I was like, maybe I'll start an influencer program with our senior leadership, like trying to find a way to make my job feel more interesting and challenging for myself. And you said, Elisa, I feel like this is the time for you to become an influencer yourself. And I loved now that you said you're not going to feel like this right now, but later you're going to see it. And that's exactly what happened. I really did focus on myself. I mean, I've definitely failed and succeeded in the last 5 years since we worked together. But I tell that story all the time because for me in my personal life, I knew it was time to make a change. I just didn't think it was that time.
And you want to choose your time,
mm-hmm.
right?
I was giving myself a year.
Yeah, you want to choose your time. And when you sort of get that push and you don't want the push, it hurts. You know, I've been on the receiving end of that. And the reason why I'm asking you that right now is because, you know, with this transaction happening, there will be people that are affected, you know, and I keep telling my team, it's all going to be okay eventually.
Yeah, eventually is a key word.
Eventually. And I understand that everyone's in a different situation. And, you know, there are folks that would welcome a couple of months off. And there are folks that positively, absolutely can't have a couple of months off because they can't survive.
And that's the case for a lot of people in tech right now.
Right. But then the good thing was we knew this transaction was coming. So I've been very upfront since, you know, we're going on 7 months now. So they've had a mm-hmm. long runway to wrap their heads around that. And that's why I wanted to ask
Which
you
is because a privilege.
I keep telling everybody it eventually will be okay. Yeah. I think there's so many people right now, you know, we've seen it, right? The great layoffs in marketing. And that comes from companies not understanding where growth comes from. You know, nobody's ever cut their way to growth. And mm-hmm. more salespeople is not going to get you there. And that's a whole nother podcast. But there's a lot of people in our industry who are struggling. And I would love for them to hear, sometimes you don't see it at the beginning, but eventually the path presents itself and eventually it's all okay.
For me personally, now this is not the case for everyone, but it was really, I think you saw it. And even though I saw it, but not in the same way, but it was time for me to create my own path. And I think that's really hard.
But I think everyone has to create their own path. You know what I mean? I do. I feel that very strongly. Even when you're staying, you have to create your own path. With this company, I've never been in a company where so many people have been with the company for so long.
Yeah, especially in a legacy company.
Right.
Like,
and they've been here. I mean, I'm working with people who have been here, you know, 22 years. Like in tech, I've never been in a company like that, right? And I think what I've been trying to impress more than anything is you are the person who is in control of your own story mm-hmm. and your own path. And everybody, I feel everybody is, you know, yes, things happen to us, you know, that we can't control. You get laid off, you get sick, whatever, but you still control the reaction to that and you still mm-hmm. control what you do about it.
Exactly. I feel like you do have to get creative in times of transition, but I also, one of my favorite quotes is, and I'm not going to quote it right, but it's something about when you have limited resources, you have exponential innovation, and it really forces you to create
Absolutely.
Something that you never knew existed.
You know, when the pandemic was going on, you know, and everyone was in a panic, you know, I remember having conversation after conversation after conversation going, yes, but wait until you see the innovation that comes out of this. Mm-hmm. Because it has to, right? Sometimes people just want to be cranky and feel bad about something, right? And that's not wrong, you know? Yeah,
sometimes you need it.
Sometimes you need it. But sometimes you got to put good things in your head because I believe, you know, your health depends on it. Like I said, looking for the opportunity of, okay, but what good can come from this, I think is mm-hmm. a good thing to ask yourself.
So, John, as we wrap up here, what do you think is, when we talk about vision, what is your vision for B2B marketing?
If I had my way, we would get rid of the word marketing because I think it just holds all kinds of negative connotations, right? It's go-to-market, which already exists, but unfortunately, we keep putting the wrong people in charge of go-to-market. Go-to-market isn't sales. Go-to-market is how do you attract your buyer in which channels, and then how do you get chosen? But unfortunately, while marketing has transformed to be digital because that's how people are finding and you know who they're going to buy from and who they should consider, sales hasn't changed that much. And I think there needs to be a complete transformation in sales and in product and in your go-to-market and your routes to market because people are buying differently. And that has to happen. And then my other soapbox, which I will quickly, I want colleges to change marketing to a STEM career because it does require science, psychology, technology, obvious, engineering. Your buyer's journey is all engineering and all of the tech stack that you put together is engineering. And at the end of the day, it's a big math equation. What you put in, there's a multiplier on what comes out. And I think, you know, by not making it a STEM career, first of all, I don't think we're preparing our young people well enough to come out, but I also think it doesn't get the respect that it deserves.
Okay, this is my first time thinking about STEM and marketing.
I'm telling you, when I have a little bit of time, I'm gonna start campaigning all the universities to change it.
I'm gonna chew on this for a bit. I love it. John, thank you so much. It was so great to catch up and hear about your successes.
I love doing this. Thank you so much for asking me.
B2B Creatively is powered by Stories Bureau. This episode was produced by Alexandra Uresta with help from Mather Dillian. It was engineered and mixed by Tim Ballant and edited by Joshua Ramsey. If you like what you hear, go follow Stories Bureau on LinkedIn, where Elisa, Corey, and the rest of the team are dishing out tips all week long. Or maybe check out storiesbureau.com. Sign up for our newsletter, and that'll keep you up to date on all the latest trends and best practices in the B2B creative, design, and marketing worlds. Oh, and of course, follow us on YouTube and your favorite podcast platform to get more creative convos like this delivered straight to your feed every month. That's it for this one. So until next time, thanks for listening.